down on him and says, "Oh, pretty boy, can't you show me nothing but surrender?" Johnny gets up, takes off his leather jacket, deep to his chest. There's the answer. He's got 10
There is this thing. Do you realize what is what? There is this thing. Do you There is this thing. On. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news are brought to you live.
Hi, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM in Montreal. My name is Sean Lathrop.
And my name is Amy Lloyd. Today we broadcast live from the Geokiage, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe Nations. The time now is 5:01.
This week's episode focuses on artist accountability. We also have our first produced audio essay, a segment we hope to be reoccurring over the coming episodes. We also have in-depth news coverage from the Daily News editor, Athena Khalid. And finally, we have an interview with Ashley, who is the founder and editor of Metatron. Metatron is an alternative literary publisher based in Montreal.
And, of course, we'll give you an update on local news. Enjoy the rest of our jingle and a little tune.
Thank you. That was more with Past the Hours. The time now is 5:07. Now for our weekly headline roundup.
Today will be the official deadline for Ontario municipalities to decide whether or not to partake in legal marijuana businesses. Some municipalities, such as the township of Brudenell, experienced petitioning from local churches, who claimed it was a health risk for those under the age of 25. But most municipalities, like Ottawa and the City of Guelph, are interested. Once communities opt in, they forfeit their right to opt out, causing local councils, like the town of Renfrew, to wait until the last minute to decide. Cannabis retailers will be in operation on the 1st of April 2019.
The McGill administration missed the January 1st deadline set by the Quebec government to adopt an updated sexual assault and violence policy. The deadline was part of Quebec's Bill 151, which was passed in December 2017 and requires all higher education institutions to revise their sexual assault and violence policies in accordance with a new set of regulations. McGill's policy against sexual violence was ratified in 2016 and is currently under revision to reflect the provincial government's new requirements. As it stands, McGill's policy fails to adhere to some of the requirements of Bill 151, such as the existence of a standalone policy and clearly defined regulations regarding professor-student relationships.
Vicky Gravel, Helen Henderson, and Sylvie Corvevo went public with their allegations of sexual assault against Dr. John A. McDougall. The three women claim that Dr. McDougall sexually assaulted them during medical examinations after being recruited by the RCMP in the 1980s. After going to both the RCMP superiors and the Toronto Police, the women's complaints were dismissed. McDougall refuted all allegations of abuse. With the rise of the hashtag MeToo movement, the women, after almost three decades, decided to go public by sharing their story with CBC and reopening their case McDougall's lawyer has reported to the press that he now has dementia and refuses to commit any further on the allegations.
Homeless shelters in Montreal are filled to capacity during this cold snap. Last Thursday, the city announced the launch of an emergency shelter at the Old Victoria site on Des-Pins Ave. The first night saw 30 people use the shelter. That number doubled to 60 the following evening, and all 80 beds were used each night during last week's winter storm.
Netflix issued an apology for including footage from the Lac Mégantic train tragedy in their new film Bird Box. However, they claim the images cannot be removed. Corey Wright, the director of global public policy for Netflix, stated that Netflix was unaware of the source of the footage and ensures it will not happen again. The cell phone footage was sold to Pond5, a stock footage company, and shows imagery of the 2013 train derailment along with an explosion which killed 47 people. That was our weekly headline roundup. Please stay tuned for a special report after this song.
I said I'll make it, I'm in the making. But I've been working double shifts while you've been playing. And I wanna say how much I like you, but I'm convinced I convinced myself not to. Been working double shifts while you've been up to. So tell me how to tell you now that it's coming. But I've been working double shifts to get your loving. Well, I noticed that you noticed me. I've been a good girl just for you, baby. Been working double shifts, it's you who made me. So tell me when to tell you again that I wouldn't mind, wouldn't mind, wouldn't mind. you call me up sometime. Got a feeling inside. Since I'm working double shifts, double rounds, double time. Maybe I forgot to mention I've been working nights for your attention, yeah. Attention, I need your attention.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. The time is 5:13. That was Double Shifts by Charlotte Cardin. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Now we have an audio essay by Amy Lloyd, produced by me.
Last Saturday, on January 19th, a group of 200 protesters gathered on Place Émile Gamelin to partake in the Women's March, otherwise known as Manifestation des Femmes. Despite temperatures dropping to negative 35 degrees Celsius, plus wind chill, the turnout was impressive. Montreal organizers of the movement declared the theme of the march would be violence against women. This will be the third anniversary of the Women's March. The first march took place in 2017 in Washington, D.C. as a response to Trump's inauguration. Here is a recording from one of the speeches given at the first initial Women's March.
His handlers have found a fox for every chicken coop in Washington, and a Twitter finger must not become a trigger finger. Some very experienced doctors of the American Psychiatric Association have publicly written to warn us that, and I quote, his widely reported symptoms of mental instability, including grandiosity, impulsivity, hypersensitivity to slights or criticisms, and an apparent inability to distinguish between fantasy and reality, lead us to question his fitness for the immense responsibilities of the office, unquote. This was on full display in his inaugural address yesterday. Everything that happened before him was a disaster, and everything that he would do would be fantastic, the best ever, miracles, and all the superlatives. He also said he was with the people. Indeed, he was the people. To paraphrase a famous quote, I just want to say, I have met the people, and you are not them. We are the people. Just this march in Washington today required 1,000 more buses than the entire inauguration. 1,000 more. And I was just talking with people from our many sister marches, including the one in Berlin, and they asked me to send a special message. We in Berlin know that walls don't work.
was a clip from Gloria Steinem's speech confronting Trump in his cabinet in 2017 during the first initial Women's March. Gloria Steinem is a American political activist, feminist, and journalist who played an instrumental role in developing feminist theories along with co-founding the popular feminist magazine, Miss. In 2017, Trump ran a controversial campaign. From sexual assault allegations to misogynistic rhetoric, many felt Trump was not willing to protect, nor respect, 50% of the American population, that being women. The Women's March began in response to Trump's victory and inauguration. Many people were shocked when Trump won, when considering his chauvinistic behavior and overall misogynistic outlook. They were surprised to discover 41% of women voted for Trump, an overwhelming majority of those votes being white women. After Election Day, Teresa Shook, a Hawaiian woman, wrote on Facebook suggesting a pro-woman march should take place in order to show solidarity. Thousands of citizens signed up to march on the 21st of January, 2017, the day after Inauguration Day. Organizers expected 200,000 people to show. Instead, 500,000 participated and visited from all over America. Many of the participants wore pink clothing, including pink knitted hats with cat ears that referenced a recording of Trump in 2005 bragging about harassing and inappropriately grabbing women. Furthermore, protesters held signs referring to themselves as nasty and a nasty woman to make fun of and respond to Trump's commentary towards Hillary Clinton during a debate on Social Security. These marches took place all over the world, from Toronto to Chicago. Following the theme of third-wave feminism, the Women's March symbolized a myriad of issues. People advocated for reproductive rights, criminal justice, environmental rights, immigration rights, issues pertaining to the LGBTQ+ community, issues pertaining to marginalized and racialized folks, and issues pertaining to folks with disabilities. Essentially, any person or issue threatened by Trump's administration. As mentioned earlier, this will be the third anniversary of the Women's March. Despite the important message these marches send, it is problematic in terms of accurately addressing the intersectionality of feminism. After Teresa Shook's Facebook post, Vanessa Rubel, a Jewish activist, journalist, and entrepreneur, felt inspired and took an active role in organizing the march. She felt it was essential to include women of color in the organization and contacted Tamika Mallory, a black gun control activist, along with Carmen Perez, a criminal justice reform activist. The three women began working as a team to plan and oversee the march. After the success of the march, the three leaders began to disagree around roles of leadership. Rubel felt that Mallory and Perez were attempting to claim the title as the main organizers, leaving Rubel on the sideline. Mallory and Perez felt it was important for them, as women of color, to have leading voices in this march. Rubel was told that as a Jewish woman, she had to understand the role Jewish people play in racism and perpetuating systemic racism. Mallory's friendship with Louis Farrakhan, a black nationalist and leader of the religious group Nation of Islam, which is known for anti-Semitic and homophobic rhetoric, led to suspicions of anti-Semitism. Ultimately, Rubel left the group, stating it was anti-Semitism that drove her to leave and begin her own march titled March On. The split of the group, which resulted in two marches, led to a division of fundamentals. The Women's March, representing women of color, and March On, also representing women whilst condemning anti-Semitism. Last week, Tamika Mallory addressed the controversy of these allegations of anti-Semitism in her speech during the Women's March.
you. To my Latina sisters, I see you. To my Asian sisters, I see you. To my disabled sisters, I see you. And to my Jewish sisters, do not let anyone tell you who I am. I see all of you. I see you and I hear your pain. Whether you are a doctor or a sex worker or one of the 800,000 furlough workers who have not received their paychecks, I see you. And to my Black sisters, I feel you deep down in my bones and in my soul. And I know that many of you heard a battle cry. You didn't know if I was okay, so you came. And you call, and you text, and you tweet it. Let me tell you and make sure that you understand who I am. No matter what they say, no matter what they write, I will not bend. My back is up straight. I will not bow. I will not break. I am who I am for over 20 years, and no media outlet and no one else will tell you. I'm telling you, I love all people, and no one will define for me who I am. Only I can do that.
That was an audio clip of Tamika Mallory's speech. The conversation around power, white supremacy, and colonialism, along with the role each one plays in sexism, is sparking other organizers to evaluate the diversity of their own marches. At the beginning of January, another women's march in Humboldt County, California, was canceled for being overwhelmingly white. Kelsey Reedy, one of the Eureka Women's March organizers, told Fox News during a Walter's World segment that it needs to represent all women, not just some women. We, Kelsey says, are postponing because of representation from our leadership team, not just the participants. Having this march just be a response to the inauguration of Trump is really missing the underlying issues. The Eureka Women's March, meant to take place on 19th of January, will now be hosting an alternate event in March to celebrate International Women's Day. Overall, the Women's March is raising awareness of how privilege, especially white privilege, excludes and further marginalizes women of color from feminism. White women must ask themselves how they perpetuate injustice and how they can educate themselves to responsibly and respectfully promote equity. By doing so, they can become better allies and make the necessary room for women of color and marginalized folks to share their stories.
Join director Christy Garland on opening night, January 25th at Cinema du Parc, for the national theatrical run of the critically acclaimed film, What Wella Wants. Journey with Wella, a young woman from the West Bank, as she pursues her unusual dream of becoming a police officer in these turbulent times. With unprecedented access, the film shows us the realities of one of today's determined young women. Montreal is the first stop as the film travels across Canadian theaters this winter. For more information, check local film listings or listen to CKUT programming to win tickets. What Wella Wants, opening January 25th. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. That was a message from one of our sponsors. The time now is 5:27. Now we have Ashley on. Hi, Ashley. Thanks so much for coming.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I just wanted to know a little bit about how you started Metatron back in 2012. What was the inspiration behind it?
Okay, well, in 2012, it was actually before Metatron was a publishing press. We actually were an event series, literary reading series in Montreal. So from 2012 to about 2014, I was organizing different literary events throughout the city. And then that naturally sort of segued into starting Metatron, which was, you know, a kind of a response to the lack of publishing support specifically for young writers in Montreal. and kind of trying to put like a new fun edge on the literary world, which I felt was really missing at the time.
And what did that transition look like? Like, how did you make the transition from more event organizing to publishing?
Yeah, so Metatron actually started with a Jeune Volontaire grant, mm-hmm. which is run out of the Emploi Québec office. And so I got a little bit of funding to put towards publication of the books. So there were like specifically about six writers in Montreal that were reading quite a bit at the event series that I was running. And I loved their work and wanted to see it get into the world, and was seeing that there wasn't really any sort of response from other publishers and wanting to support their work. So I just decided to do it myself. And 7 years later, well, I guess it's been, wait, what are we, 2019? Oh my God. 2014. So 5 years later, I'm still here doing it.
So you talked about these sort of events that started off this whole process. And Metatron often hosts these events in places like Montreal, Toronto, Brooklyn. What kind of environment would you say you try and create in these like readings?
Yeah, it's, for me, an atmosphere is so important, and I think I started doing the event series because I was going to readings and they were kind of, you know, a little bit more boring, and everyone was really polite and quiet, which is very, very nice, but I really wanted to kind of do, it started off more as like a party literary reading, and then over the years, it's just been really important for me to do events in really unique spaces. We hardly ever do events in the same space, and collaborating with different people and communities and creating just like a fun environment where lots of different voices can be heard.
So you talked a little bit about how Metatron sort of focuses on making room for people. And I was wondering, the publishing industry is notoriously like not very open, especially to women. So I was wondering mm-hmm. how being a woman in the publishing industry has shaped your experience like of it all.
Yeah, I think it's just made it, for me, very, very important to publish women. And over the years, you know, my understanding of who I need to be supporting has expanded. And, you know, as Metatron grows and as I slowly have access to more power in the publishing industry, it's really important for me to use that power to enlighten as many people or empower as many people, amplify voices of as many different people as possible. So, you know, I think as women, you know, and I'm not trying to gender it, but we are prone to being a lot more empathetic towards people. And I think that sort of like empathy approach to my work has really, really influenced me.
And I'm just wondering sort of along the lines of inclusivity, how does Metatron, you know, incorporate inclusivity into its publishing? Like, does it ensure that Black and Indigenous people of color have a platform? Like, in what ways is it working to include?
Yeah, that's been something, like, as I said, Metatron started off very much as a feminist press and a queer press as well. And, you know, over the years and the kind of conversations that we've been having in Montreal and the diversity that we have in the city, it's really important for me to reflect that in the press. So at first, it was difficult because at the end of the day, it's about the submissions that you're getting. Mm-hmm. So just because you're open to getting submissions from marginalized people doesn't mean that you're going to get them.
Right.
So then it becomes, you know, kind of, it becomes more direct action mm-hmm. and reaching out to specific people and showing it up to certain events and creating real relationships with people. So it's more than just being open mm-hmm. and it's more about intentionality, and it's more for me about action and about creating like real connections. You know, so there is like a very genuine like connection there.
You said something in a previous interview that I really liked. You said that Metatron is a diverse and dynamic press that represents the underrepresented voices in our culture. But then you said that you try not to use diversity as a boasting point, which I think is really important in mm-hmm. our current cultural climate. So how do you strike that that balance? How would you say you promote visibility when you grant prizes, like mm-hmm. like the Metatron Prize for Rising Authors?
Yeah, for me, it's more about, I never want to be applauded for the work that I'm doing in that realm. Like, I feel like we should all be doing that work, and I think that it should just set a new standard. In terms of reading submissions, like, we always try to consider, I mean, we always do consider where people are coming from, who they are. People often open up to us in their submissions and say, like, this is where I'm coming from, this is who I am. And when we're considering people for publication and people for winning the prize, that's definitely something that we really take into account. I think another really important comment, though, is that in terms of diversity, of course, there is like diversity on the level of authors, but what is really important that lots of people don't talk about is like a diverse editorial board and, you know, who is editing their work. You know, so that's also been something that I've worked really hard on the last couple of years, is making sure that our editorial board has diversity within it as well.
So sort of segueing to another question that I have, what would you say the biggest challenge that you faced was since getting started?
I think for all arts organizations will say the same thing, but money is always a thing.
Yeah.
It takes money to do things, and, you know, publishing specifically poetry, which Metatron does, is, you know, it's such a niche market. So we do heavily depend on grants. So money has been a big challenge. And I think also just continuing to create safe, inclusive spaces in every realm of the press has also been a huge challenge. There's a lot of, like, interpersonal conflicts and, you know, things that are constantly going on between authors and within the community. So, you know, that has also been a very interesting and challenging thing to move through as well.
Do you have any sort of like accountability processes? So if you feel like an author or a person on the editorial board is not behaving in the way that they should?
Yeah, we do. I don't want to get into a whole lot of detail right now, but there actually have been a handful of events that I've had to go through. And it kind of seems like processes of accountability are always unique in their own way. Like, I think it's really important to have that devotion, but each situation also has its own complexities. Right. So it's, every time something comes up, it always demands like a lot of time and thinking and talking and considering both sides of the story and communication. So so accountability is really, really important to me. And I do take a lot of time and energy and take everything really seriously, but nothing really like bad has happened, but there's been, you know, there's been under the scenes stuff that's gone on for sure.
On a lighter note, what author, poet are you most excited about working with this year?
We so far have said yes to three books.
Oh, wow.
So it's unfair of me. I'm excited like about all of them. But I am also very, very excited that we're publishing our first Indigenous author this year. A Dene Cree Hungarian writer from Vancouver.
Wow.
Named Tawaham. Okay. Currently, the name of his book is Political and Personal. And he's actually in court today because he was one of the people who were fighting on the front lines for the anti-pipeline protest in BC.
And the Wet'suwet'en territory.
Exactly.
Wow.
So I wanted to send a shout out to Tawaham, and I hope everything goes in his favor today.
Yeah, me too. So if you could recommend any of your chapbooks or one out of any of the ones that you have published, like not just the ones you're looking forward to this year, which one would you be the most excited to recommend to young readers, university readers, like intro poetry?
Intro poetry. I mean, all the books. I mean, we've done about 36 books, and it would be unfair of me to pick one. But I will say Natalia Hero's Hum that we just put out, it's actually a novella. Is really beautiful. It's actually, I think it should be taught in schools because it actually details the sort of like emotional effects that sexual assault has on a specific person in the book. And I think it's done in a really accessible and beautiful way. It, you know, targets some very difficult subject matter, very relevant subject matter in a great way. So, and actually that book is going to be translated into French very soon. So that's very exciting. And I guess the other book I'll mention is An Indoor Kind of Girl by Frankie Barnett, which is actually a collection of short stories, so I'm not actually answering your question. But that book is also coming out in French, actually, in March by Edition... oh, my gosh, what are they called? Oh, my gosh, this is so bad. Tête à Mère.
Okay, perfect. Just another question about, like, young people in poetry or, you know, young people in literature in general. How important do you think it is for young people to be involved in sort of a process, like a literature process? Like, you were talking about you created Metatron for young people because you didn't think there was enough space for them.
Mm-hmm. I think it's so important. Like, I think, you know, people who have access to, I think expressing yourself is one of the most powerful things on earth. And I think that poetry really does create a space where that's encouraged. And I think that if more people had access to, more young people had access to the tools of poetry, that there would be like a lot more self-awareness. I feel like poetry does lend itself to that. Mm-hmm. And also being able to read about other people's experiences and engage with other people's stories through poetry is really powerful. I think, you know, young people should totally use poetry as a means to express themselves and also to understand the people around them.
Yeah, I just want to also talk about sort of the work you've been doing with engaging young people. So I noticed that you recently started publishing Instagram poems, mm-hmm. which I think is really cool, getting submissions and publishing them online. You've been publishing work on your blog Omega for years now. How do you feel poetry has changed with the popularity of social media? I'm thinking specifically about successes like Rupi Kaur, mm-hmm. Other poets who got their start online.
Yeah. Well, I have so much to say about Rupi Kaur, and she's brought up every time I'm interviewed. I love her, and I think that she's created a lot of like love and excitement about the world of poetry, which I think is great. I think in terms of social media poetry, one way that this has been influenced is that poems are a lot shorter than they used to be.
Yes.
And, you know, and I think that there has been a lot of backlash about the sort of like shallowness of Instagram poetry, which I think is totally in some ways heralded. But I think that instead of like pushing back against something that is naturally happening in the poetry world, that we should embrace it and create space for it. And I think that it's a really fun, accessible way to get into poetry.
Yeah, I sort of wanted to talk about that pushback because I know that some serious poetry people, like I'm thinking about a professor of mine, he's like a modernist poet, mm-hmm. but it's more widespread. You can see it on the internet. People have pushed back really hard up against internet poetry. Do you think it has to do with who is allowed to be a poet? Like, I think that certain forms of expression are now being opened up to young, queer women in a way that, like, they weren't before. Mm-hmm. And then, is it about white heteronormativity being threatened?
Yeah, possibly. I think for sure. I think, you know, the publishing industry has really changed, and you don't need a publisher to, or anyone to open a door for you in order for you to share your work. And I think that is really threatening to this, like, the industry of literature. But for me, like, that's so exciting. I think that's where, like, things get really exciting and interesting, when you kind of take away those gatekeepers and you know, and people have the power to kind of, you know, just publish on their own. So I think, you know, to answer your question, I think everyone has their own taste in poetry, mm-hmm. and we're all entitled to have our own taste in poetry, and there's no reason to hate on any sort of tradition or anything. There's space for all of it.
I wanted to ask you how you would respond to the critique that I've read online, funnily enough, that social media is commodifying poetry and sort of saturating it with even more capitalism.
Mm.
Which is sort of funny because you're buying books. So.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, social media has commodified everything, from our human emotions to our identities to our feelings. Yeah. So, and that's going on social media. But at the same time, not many people are making actual money. You know, but there is, you know, the question, I mean, there is, you know, social currency as well, which is a huge thing. But yeah, I don't think poets are making a hell of a lot of money on their poetry online. And if they are, good for them.
Or do them.
Yeah.
So this is like a kind of personal question, because I really like sort of the academia poetry crossover.
Mm-hmm.
I loved Maggie Nelson's Bluettes.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I'm trying to be hyper aware of privilege and accessibility. So, like, do you think that academic poetry is accessible?
I studied creative writing
at
Concordia. And, you know, I think that there's a space in the world and a place for academic poetry, but I don't think that generally academic poetry is accessible to the common reader.
Right.
And I think that the work that I specifically have done with Metatron is I really want poetry to be accessible and that people don't feel dumb when they read it. You know, I think that, you know, sometimes when people think of poetry, they're like, oh, I don't understand that, or I'm not smart enough or philosophical enough to understand that. So I really, I don't know. I think that academic poetry can be inaccessible, but if you, you know, because there's so much like background to an academic text that you need to know, and not everyone has, you know, the privilege of going to university.
Exactly. I guess you sort of answered my next question, which is about, you know, is it fair to critique a work for being too based in tradition? And also, is it fair to critique a work for not being based enough in it? I think you sort of said there should be space for both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
How do you see poetry and sort of cultural criticism interplaying with one another?
Can you expand a little bit on that?
Yeah. Sort of like, how do you feel, like, do you feel poetry as a social responsibility? Like, there's something that people are trying, like, you should be conscious of what you publish because people are reading it?
Yeah, I think for sure. And I think people should be held accountable for what they say and write and the ideas they have. So I think for sure. Yeah, I think 100%.
I also read that you and your team respond with feedback to almost every submission you receive, and that's like a massive undertaking. How do you go about giving feedback, and why do you think hearing back from editors is so important for an author?
It's so important. I think that, you know, because I'm also a writer, so I remember submitting work a long time ago, and to get a rejection and not know exactly why you're being rejected, you know, it can be challenging. You kind of feel like you're like living in an echo chamber. So, you know, with that said, our submissions have like tripled over the years, and we don't, you know, unfortunately, given our resources, we can't respond and give feedback to every single person. So that's something like, unfortunately, we have kind of segued out of a little bit, but we do respond to everyone, and we're very open to hearing back from people, and we're not like stingy with our time and feedback. It's just, is it like,
it's a lot.
Know, it's a lot. But, you know, I think when we first started the prize, for the first 3 years, we did feedback for like everyone.
Wow.
And that was challenging too, though, because you want to give a really like insightful response to everyone, but in reality, it, you know, it's already taking so much time to read a manuscript, and so I wish I had a superhuman skills that I could do that for everyone, but I am, you know, just one person, unfortunately.
Yeah, you are just one person, and it seems like the editorial role that you have is pretty, like, you take on a lot. And I honestly don't know much about an editorial role in terms of poetry, so like, what does that look like? Like, other than responding, like, do you edit down poems? Do you change? Do you, like, I don't.
Anything that we publish online is not touched.
Okay.
So it just appears as is. But when we do decide to do a book with someone, they do get a couple months of editorial feedback with an editor.
Wonderful.
So that will usually be a Google Doc, and you're never, like, changing or taking anything out, but you're asking questions, making comments, sort of, like, more engaging them on the choices that they've made. So, yeah, from an editorial point of view, yeah, we don't touch work that is online. But, yeah, when we're doing a book, we do very carefully try and construct the poems so they can be the best they can be.
And finally, this is my last question. What are you most excited about in this upcoming year?
Well, the new books that we're putting out are amazing. I'm so excited to put those out. I really want to do more events in the city this year. So there's that. And actually, I'm really excited about the Instagram poetry series that we're doing right now. It's like bringing a lot of new people to our channel. And it feels, I took a little bit of a break from publishing work online because I didn't know if I wanted to do a blog or a magazine. And this Instagram poetry idea came to my mind, and it doesn't seem to me that anyone else is really curating that right now. Yeah. So we're getting a ton of submissions, so naturally there's a lot of energy in that right now, so I'm very excited.
Some of them are so funny.
I know.
Reading them. They're so good.
I know. They're so good. You guys should check it out, Metatron Press on Instagram.
So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on all your success.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Stay warm, everyone.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. That was Christina Alcorta with No Good. Now we have a news report from the Daily's news editor, Athena Khalid.
On January 14th, around 75 people gathered at the Y intersection on McGill campus. This protest was organized by the ISA, the Indigenous Student Alliance, in solidarity with the Unistoten camp. The protest comes in light of recent RCMP encroachment on the Unistoten land, which is in Wet'suwet'en territory, unceded territory of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. While the RCMP states that it was enforcing the rule of law, many at the protest argued that Canadian laws do not acknowledge Indigenous sovereignty, rights, and legal customs, not to mention the fact that within Canadian law, this land is sovereign land, is unceded territory. The McGill Daily's two news stories regarding McGill news were, one, the ISA rally on January 14th, and two, a roundtable discussion with Principal Susan Fortier. For the ISA rally, it took place, as I said, on January 14th, when 75 people gathered at the Y intersection in solidarity with the Unistoten camp. The Unistoten camp is a camp on Wet'suwet'en territory in northern British Columbia. Recently, as it has come to light, because of a BC Supreme Court injunction which ordered that a gate come down that was blocking Coastal GasLink workers from accessing the camp. The RCMP enforced the injunction, arguing that it was enforcing the rule of law. However, Wet'suwet'en Nation members and the residents of the Unistoten camp believe this is their sovereign territory, and that RCMP encroachment goes against their sovereignty, rights, and legal customs. One of the organizers of the gathering and co-chair of ISA, Ella Martindale, spoke at the protest about how this issue goes beyond pipelines. This is not only about protesting a pipeline, but rather about Indigenous sovereignty. Claire Grenier, co-news editor of the McGill Daily, sat down with Principal Suzanne Fortier and numerous other representatives of the student press for a roundtable discussion. The McGill Tribune asked a question about the restructuring of the seed office. The response to that was quite vague, but mainly that it's being restructured to be more efficient, so essentially that different parts of seed are going to be under different offices. The McGill Daily asked a question about the Change the Name campaign, but also more generally about trust in the administration. The Change the Name campaign question was responded with a discussion of the task force on renaming. but not much more than that. And the question of trust was talked about, but essentially in terms of the long-term process of building trust. The McGill Tribune also asked about the January 1st deadline to implement the sexual violence policy, and about the fact that the McGill and other universities in Quebec and CEGEPs have missed the deadline. The response here was essentially that because McGill has had a sexual violence policy since 2016, the deadline wasn't missed. However, the Bill 151 stipulates a bill that has far more requirements than the bill currently in place at McGill. It was also stated that there is a policy revision that will come to Senate in February, and that that essentially the big deadline, per se, of having a policy was not missed because there's one in 2016, and the revisions will take place, will come about in March. In terms of Montreal news, our first story was about the BEI proving to be ineffective. The BEI stands for the Bureau of Independent Investigations, and it was founded in 2015 following a series of police shootings and cover-up scandals. It's a civilian-led watchdog organization that provides checks and balances on Quebec's police forces. A CBC article revealed in a January 15 article that half of all accusations of police misconduct processed by the BEI came from Indigenous people. According to the Daily's research, of the 110 investigations opened up by the BEI, only two led to charges, and both of those charges were not able to go to sentencing because both of the officers who were charged died before sentencing. The Open Door Shelter was a shelter that was located on Atwater and Dorchester Streets, just on the edge of Westmount. In 2017, the church that it was housed in, St. Stephen's Anglican Church, was sold to developers, and as a result, the Open Door was supposed to relocate. In December of last year, the Open Door moved to Notre-Dame de Salette Church, located on Park. The director of the Open Door, David Chapman, told the Daily that the change has been well received by the people with whom the shelter works.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print on CKUT. This is Cold to the Touch by Ralph. To close out our show on this cold winter night, I just wanted to say thank you to Ashley from Metatron who came on. Please tune in next week for a special episode on media accountability. We will be interviewing Jesse Brown, a McGill grad who started the alternative media podcast Canada Land, as well as representatives from Cinema Politica Concordia. We will also have news reporting on the Day of Remembrance and Action on Islamophobia. We will be interviewing activist groups. This has been Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We will see you next week. But I'm gonna let you down. Don't wanna hurt you, just like I did before. Remember the empty words.
want it. Oh, tonight I need it. But I'm gonna let you down. Don't wanna hurt you, just like I did before. Remember the empty words. Why you keep coming back for more? Not looking for love. Hate to say it, but it's time you give it up. Just trying to be honest. Why you keep coming back for more? Not looking for love. Hate to say it, but it's time you gave it up. Just trying to be honest.
Episode 21, Ulume January 22, and Malu, Nippy Bumit, Nala Lame Yosi. To Saksolangaji, Ulume, Nali, Waitalo, Ohalamahate Hakti Logo, Glen Gear Mik, Tan Glen Gear, Night to Me, Dr. Jalunat, Atili Mihalunat, and Malu, Tana Saina Nali, Ohalamahate Halangamayo, Nukar Minik, JPT Mit, Tanago JPT, Twitter Bot Hangat. Inum maribat mit atilimit. Nala katalanga meyo sinit jadu net inutitu tu net ammalo inutitu ilinertitu langa meyo si ukausam. Hi, this is Annie Pisuti and you're listening to Nippy Wood, January 22.